Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Spec Talk Radio, Southeast Private Equity Community Radio Show, where entrepreneurs and investors come together to learn more about angel investing, about creating wealth through early stage investing in entrepreneurial endeavors, and in generally all about building successful companies. And today we have an incredibly special show planned. We have famed author Scott Shane of Fool's Gold with us today. He's going to talk about sort of the inspiration behind that book, the impact it's having on educating our marketplace on what does it really mean to attract investors and what angel investors really are all about. And we're going to get started here in just a minute with him. And it's we're excited about this. He's got some great insights. I got this book as a pre-release and was tickled pink to get it and to be able to have a chance to review it, since it's so much of what we do with connecting companies with capital through the network of business angels and investors. That's nbanight.net. And through our consulting services group, Launch Funding Network, launchfn.com. Again, this is Karen Ranz with Spec Talk Radio. And on the air with me is Scott Shane, the author of Fool's Gold. Welcome, Scott.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So now, you know, this is, I'm not sure, I know within the angel investor community, and we're involved with the Angel Capital Association, your book has created a little bit of a uproar, because you've definitely gone contrary to a lot of the common I guess concepts and perceptions of what's out there with the angel investors, and we're going to kind of jump into that. But what kind of feedback are you getting on your book so far from the different sources and folks that have read it?
Well, the feedback's been pretty good, and in fact, you know, some of the people, actually several of the people who are heavily involved at the Angel Capital Association, actually commented on the book jacket. So I think what's happened with a lot of people is to say, yeah, I think what we want to believe is that everybody's really good at this, and there's a lot of people who do it and do it well. And I think what the book is pointing out with the data is there's some people who do it and do it well, but they're actually a small minority of the total, and that we should either think about a small group of angels doing a phenomenal amount of successful stuff, that small group that does it really well, or if we want to think about a large group of angels doing this stuff, then we really need to think about a lot of them not doing it so well.
Right, absolutely. Well, I know that, because it was interesting, I was at the, representing the Network of Business Angels and Investors, I had attended the Angel Capital Association meeting they had for the Southeast in Savannah, I guess about a month or so ago, and we're sitting at dinner, and I had just received your book probably about 2 weeks before as an early release, and I had taken it with me on the plane out to a trip I took to California, and it was still in my bag when I went over there. You know, I didn't really have any kind of it was actually, in one case, it was sort of an impetus for me to reach out to the Angel Capital Association because of seeing their involvement in there, and then I saw that they had this event, and I went to it. And so we're sitting at dinner, and I mentioned, I said, well, what do you think about this new book that's coming out, Fool's Gold? And it was like E.F. Hutton. talks, right? Because they hadn't seen the pre-release of it yet. And they were, and it was John May was there, you know, the former president of the Angel Capital Association. He was sitting across the table from me, and they kind of like looked around like, how did you get that, you know? So I gave him my copy for them to look over the weekend, and he shared some insights on it and during one of the breakout sessions and roundtables that he had later on. But it was kind of interesting because, you know, as looking through your information, the thing that that struck me is so much of what that paradigm that's out there, the stereotype of who the angel investor is exactly what we deal with on a day in day out basis with entrepreneurs coming with us saying, you know, I just want to find four guys that'll put $250,000 in a piece, and I'm done with my raising my capital. You know, and we explained to them that it really doesn't work that way. You know, I mean, trying to find somebody that's going to put that big of a check in is, you know, extremely rare because of the nature of, you know, diversification and portion of their portfolio and their comfort level with you and, you know, all of those kinds of factors that actually come into the decision-making process. So I thought it was very refreshing to see your take on this, that, you know, which really resetting that paradigm of who that angel investor is. And I think that my group sort of falls in the middle of what you talk about, sort of from your informal investors to what the business investors or the business angels are. So let's dive into that a little bit. Let me introduce Dr. Shane just a little bit more. He's actually an active angel investor with the North Coast Angel Fund and is a professor of entrepreneurial studies at Case Western Reserve University and has authored over 60 scholarly articles as well as a number of books. And one of the books that I saw when I was doing some research setting up the interview, The Illusion of Entrepreneurship. So that was a book that came out just really earlier this year, right? So The Fool's Gold is going to just coming off of the coattails of that book.
Right, they're actually about 1 year apart, almost exactly.
Oh, okay. So you're an investor, you're a professor of entrepreneurship. You started out with, talking about, you know, really sort of setting that or resetting the expectations of entrepreneurship with this other book. What was, you know, did you already have Fool's Gold in mind when you wrote that book, or did the inspiration for it kind of come from the process of writing your other book on the illusions of entrepreneurship?
Well, they actually came a little bit differently. So the illusions of entrepreneurship actually came about because I noticed myself making a lot of errors actually in the research that I was doing, that I was starting to believe all these things that people say. And then I'd go look at the data and, you know, check it four times because the data wasn't consistent with what I believed. And so that was sort of, a book that was motivated by, look, if I'm really not believing this data the data is really quite strong and it's convincing, there's probably a lot of people out there that are laboring under misconceptions. The Fool's Gold came about a little bit differently, which was that I had been doing some work for several of the Federal Reserve banks a few years ago and did a bunch of focus groups on angel investing. And the thing that happened in those focus groups is that you'd have a bunch of people sitting around the room all saying that they're describing angel investing, each one describing it differently and each one defining it differently, and there being just a huge amount of confusion over what it actually was. And so I was sort of motivated to try to figure out more about it from there. You know, things like, you know, if people can be either accredited investors doing this, or there's some people who everybody points out are not accredited investors. Well, how many of them aren't accredited, right? And how many of these people, you know, are writing these $250,000 checks, and how many of them are writing $10,000 checks, and how many of them are really doing this, you know, five companies a year, and how many of them doing, you know, one company every 15 years. And that was the impetus in trying to sort of figure this out. And then, you know, in doing that, the patterns kind of took shape in terms of what the story was that, you know, kind of came out of all the information that I gathered.
Okay, so now, so let's get a little bit into, dig a little bit into that. So the definition of angels, because you use a couple of different terms or a few terms. You have, you know, informal angels, and you have business angels. So, do you, is, are they all, are they all distinct, or are they sort of a food chain where somebody starts out as a informal angel and then kind of goes through some of that, they become more sophisticated and become associated with a group that can help them with due diligence and become a business angels, or describe that a little bit and kind of how you have defined that.
Okay,
that's
sure.
That's such an area of confusion for folks.
Right, so I start with a kind of broader idea that there's some people out there that are informal investors. That is, they're people who are making investments with their own money, and that's what makes an informal investor different than everybody else. A venture capitalist is raising, you know, funds from institutions, and banks are institutions, but people investing their own money, those are informal investors. And, you know, historically we talk about informal investors having, you know, three groups under the, or two groups under the umbrella, friends and family on the one hand and angels on the other, right? That's the overall umbrella. Then you get, so angels are a subset of all these informal investors, as friends and family are another subset of these informal investors.
Okay.
Then within the angels, we can now think about different dimensions of angels. So one part is, okay, are these accredited investors, the kind of high net worth people that we think about when we think about, you know, when you kind of read your typical article about angel investing, you know, the John Mays of the world, those are accredited investors making these investments predominantly in high-tech companies. That's one category. But then there's a bunch of people who actually aren't accredited investors. And then within the accredited, because everybody's got to be an accredited investor to be part of an angel group, essentially, are people part of these groups that have been growing, all the groups that are members of the Angel Capital Association and the ones that aren't, or are they acting, you know, as individuals making these investments, but they're not participating in a group?
Okay, so once they've kind of taken the channel and they're what you consider informal investors, but officially angels, then they may or may not be in a group associated with a group, but they're not in the category of a friends and family investor.
Right. So I've got some money. I want to invest it. I, you know, put it in somebody's business, and they're, you know, my cousin. That's a, you know, in the friends and family category. I put it in my best friend's business. That's friends and family. But I go find some stranger that comes along, or somebody who's introduced to me by some acquaintance or something like that, and I make the investment, and that's going to fall in the category of angel because it's not a friend or family.
Okay.
And then,
so,
go ahead.
So kind of like one of the things that we sort of, as we've been working to rebuild the network of business angel investors, we've been trying to tap into probably those folks that consider themselves sort of that friends and family category, and having them move across the aisle to business angels, because they don't think of the term angel investor. They don't think of themselves that way. They think of themselves as being a silent partner, or taking, you know, I want to own a little piece of a company, you know, things like that, that they don't necessarily think of themselves as being in the business of investing.
Right. And actually, one of the things that comes out of about of this process of doing this book is that most people who make angel investments don't actually think of themselves as being in the business of making angel investments. In fact, that, you know, the kind of typical thing is that a person does one of these or maybe two during the course of a career, as opposed to making them regularly. So the number of people who are making 5, 6, 7 angel investments, the ones where they might really think of themselves as doing that, are a pretty small portion of the total.
Sure. Yeah. Now, that would be consistent with what we see and what, you know, in my own research on, you know, the majority of the investors that are out there are not associated with groups. And we found it's for a couple of different reasons. Probably the number one reason is that of proximity. You know, when they're just not in a city where there is a group, you're not in a major city necessarily where there is a group. And so they're not even aware of the potential to be a part of that or any of the benefits of being a part of that. The second piece of it is because they're just not as active. They don't see what's the point of going to a group that I've got to go to on a regular basis because I'm not really going to do that much.
Right. Now, you know, here's just this kind of simple distribution points out a lot of information for people who are thinking about either being an angel or getting money from an angel. So if there's a lot of people who do this maybe once or a couple times during their career, there's several things that we know about those people. They're not diversified the way that the experts about angel investing say is important, right? So if, you know, these are high-risk investments and a small number of them will succeed and you really want to do a portfolio of them if you really have any chance of making money off of it, the vast majority of people aren't approaching it with that kind of diversification. They're not approaching it that way. And so the question is, well, maybe they have a different motivation. And it turns out that that seems to be the pattern, that you've got people who maybe are doing this because they want to help out somebody they know or help out people in the community, and their return expectations aren't actually that high. They're not thinking about it financially. They're saying, you know what, I'm going to put $25,000 into somebody's business, and then maybe I'm never going to think about doing that again for another decade. And that's a really different person than somebody who joins an angel group and makes, you know, maybe an investment every single year for, you know, 10 straight years and spends a lot of time, you know, doing due diligence and is really hoping to get a return off of that investment and, you know, understanding who's successful and why and what, you know, you would expect to get from your angel if you're raising money from them depends a lot on where they, you know, where they are in these categories.
Yeah, I thought it was really interesting in some of the things, and it's consistent with what you were just saying, that those types of angels, since the majority of the angels that are out there, or the people that put money in, we're not keeping with the vernacular, the people that put money into early stage companies, not necessarily thinking of themselves as an angel, since the majority of the folks that are actually providing that early stage capital or providing that capital, that you say that it's really a relationship, or in my world, and what we, when we're educating entrepreneurs, we call it subjective sale. It's a subjective decision that they make, because I think you had a statistic that says 35% of what was the number, that they pay little attention to what the business plans say, with as many as 35% not even caring if the entrepreneurs whose businesses they are considering financing have a business plan. So that's completely an emotional decision, because it's somebody I know, or somebody referred to me, and I fell in love with what they were trying to do, or I like the guy.
Right, exactly. Or it could even be a kind of different angle on the same thing, which is, you're in Toledo, Ohio, and it's kind of seen better days, and this guy is going to start a business that's going to, you know, rejuvenate manufacturing in, you know, Toledo, and that's an important thing to do, and so I'm going to put some money into, you know, that guy's business, because, you know, it helps our community. It's going to make it a better place for our kids.
You know, very interesting you use that example, because we get companies within LaunchFM, we get companies that come to us from all over the country that are looking for, they always say, venture capital or angel investors, and probably 20 or 30% of them are those kind of things where, you know, I'm in a little town where there's a need for a skate park so that the kids have a place to play. There's this old building that needs to be renovated that could do that, and it would be great for our community, and I've got this whole, you know, idea of all this stuff I'm going to do, and I'll say, I'm sorry, and there's nobody in my group that's going to invest in that because you're, you know, 1,000 miles away. It's not a scalable kind of a business, and I take them through all that. You need to go to your chamber of commerce. You need to go to the mayor. You need to go to those folks and sell them on your vision, because they have a vested interest in helping you be successful. And that's kind of exactly, because that mayor or that chamber of commerce guy is probably not what they would consider an angel investor, but would be motivated based on the example you gave for those same reasons, and be involved in helping them be successful financially as well as within the community to support that endeavor.
But what happens, what I think is sort of fascinating about the patterns, is that what happens is exactly this, that actually works, and that you get a bunch of people who have these retail businesses or a personal service business that isn't scalable, right?
Right.
And you would say, and there's no way they're going to be able to raise money from this kind of in this kind of model that we think about when we often think about angel investors. And so, you know, you send them away or other people send them away, and then you go and you look at the statistics, and lo and behold, they managed to raise money from their business from a stranger, okay? Somebody who wasn't a friend and family investor, who's not an institution, and, you know, they're providing that money. Now, it has to be that the people who are providing that money, their reasons for doing it aren't that they're going to, you know, this company's going to go public and make a huge amount of money, because both sides are going to realize that that's not going to happen. But it's not that these businesses just disappear and they don't get money. It's that they get money from some kind of angel, that is, a person who's in their local community who isn't going to have those high return expectations and who wants to get involved and do that. And this is the kind of interesting thing to me, is that, you know, either you can have an angel investment umbrella that's kind of very small and says, you know, you got maybe 4,000 or 5,000 people in the whole country doing this kind of investing, and they're all investing in, you know, high-tech companies, and their goal is to take them public or get them acquired by public companies, and angel investing is actually not very many times larger than the, you know, number of people doing venture capital, and that's pretty small. Or, you know what, they're not, everybody's trying to, you know, take companies public and get them acquired by big public corporations. They're just trying to invest for a whole variety of reasons, and then you get a bigger umbrella of who are angels.
Sure, right. And actually, Scott, I got some feedback from one of my staff members that listens in that you're a little low on your volume, so I don't know if you can, if you have a headset on or something, you can adjust that.
Yeah, let's try to get that up a little higher.
Yeah, that's good. Along that same point, I think, and that might be the reason why, because I was intrigued by the fact that, and I'm trying to find the statistic here, but you talk that the largest amount, if you look at the full size of this whole pool of the friends and family type investor and the business angel investor, that a larger percentage goes into retail businesses, which would be consistent with what you're saying, because they're trying to help somebody in their local community or somebody that they know that's starting up a lifestyle type of a business. And so that's why it ends up skewing those numbers that way, because when you look at the statistics that come out from the Venture Capital Research Association out of New Hampshire, and of course all they're doing is querying business angel groups, right? You know, the numbers are completely the other way, right? It's much higher in technology, software, biomed, and very, very small in retail. So, you know, it's interesting,
right,
you know, that...
Yeah, so here's the kind of core of the contradiction here. So you got places like the Angel Capital Association, so the organizations, the angel groups that are members of that, they definitely focus on technology businesses, rarely do kind of retail stuff. But when you look at the total amount of money they invested in, say, 2006, that total is about $250 million, right? You look at the statistics on the total amount of angel investment activity that occurred in roughly the same period, it's about $20 billion, right? So what you've got is if you want to have this be a large dollar amount, if this is a big market in terms of dollars, $20 billion, much bigger than $250 million, then you're getting all these people who are making these kinds of local retail types of investments as part of the angel activity. But you know, angel groups, while they're growing a lot, you know, $250 million of money put into companies in the United States is a small portion of how companies get financed in this country.
Right. So it's one of the questions that do you find, where did you get your statistics on all these, since, you know, there's not a query that can be done with the angel groups to find these folks that are not part of formal angel groups and their behavior patterns? Where did you get your data for this information?
So there are a couple places. So that Federal Reserve for a number of years, periodically every few years, did something that they called the Survey of Small Business Finance, where there's some information about which businesses that were small businesses in the United States got angel funding. And they also do a survey of consumer finances, and from that you can figure out where consumers put their money in. So those are kind of one area of information. Another area of information is that the Kauffman Foundation funded a survey a few years ago that was of informal investors in the United States and did a representative sample of the population about informal investing. And that's another place where we can get this kind of representative stuff. You know, the book contains information that comes from these focus groups of that I did for the Federal Reserve and information from the Angel Capital Association and other places as well. But, you know, part of this is that this is one of the problems we have in understanding angel investment is that we tend to go to a small group of people that we know to be angels and make a certain kind of investment and say, what did you do? Okay, so you go to a bunch of angel groups and say, what did you do? And then you get accurate information about what the angel groups do, but then how do you extrapolate from there? They don't represent the other people who are doing something different. And so the idea was, well, what happens if we take a representative sample of the population? What does it look like? And you find out that people are doing the same general category of things, but in different kinds of companies for a little bit different reasons, in different amounts of money with different financial instruments than you see the angel groups doing it.
Okay. So, yeah. So that, so it's primarily because kind of going back, so circling back just a bit, they're making smaller investments based on a relationship. These typical, the majority of the folks that are out there that we would consider providing capital that's not a bank capital or not institutional money because it's their own money. So they're making smaller investments than we would expect, based on a relationship either or some kind of emotional connection to either the entrepreneur or the product that they're providing. And that's where the majority of the capital that goes into really any small business, whether it's a lifestyle business or a business that's scalable to be some big business. And so your numbers, they get when you throw in, because I thought it was really interesting when you talked about the amount of angel investment compared to venture capital compared to the IPO market and the whole, you know, food chain of capital. But it is, you know, it's where, and I think we would agree, it's, you know, where jobs are created, whether it's the restaurant that's got 10 employees or 5 employees or the high-tech company that, you know, a couple of years from now is going to have 50 or 100 employees. It's all with those early stage or those small businesses that grow at whatever level. And it's important for them to be able to tap into this informal type of capital to get going, because there's really, once they go beyond their own savings, there's not a way for them to get that capital until they're bankable, right?
Right. And so I think part of this is that there's so many different kinds of businesses and there's so many different models for funding businesses that, you know, I think that part of the problem that a lot of people get is that they get this kind of linear model of stages of financing, right, as opposed to types. So they think about, okay, so you take your own money, you put it in, then you get an angel, then you go from an angel to a, you know, venture capitalist, or you go from an angel to being bankable or something, and, you know, that's the investment process. Well, it turns out that the data tell you a different story. They tell you about not about a chain so much as about types. There's a bunch of businesses that when they get started can get money from anybody but the founders. That's just the way they are. And then other businesses can basically get it from the founders and they can get it from credit card companies. And then there's a bunch of businesses that can get money from trade creditors and they can get money from banks actually right off the bat because they've got some assets there in those businesses. And then there are businesses where you might go to a friend or family member, and then from there to an angel, or from a friend and family member, then to a venture capitalist, or there are ones where you don't go to the friend or family member at all. You just go straight to the angel, and you end with the angel. And then there's ones where you go to the angel, and you go to the venture capitalist. And so part of this is, and then there's guys who just go straight to the venture capitalist. And part of this is that everything isn't this kind of model, and the professors of entrepreneurship are probably the worst offenders of this because we write these textbooks that create these, like, you know, these processes and say, you know, you start with this and then you go to that and then you go to that. The reality is you have a certain type of business and you got to figure out what's the best capital source for that kind of business, and that may be the only source of capital that you get. You may get, it may be an angel and nothing after that. It may be a bank and nothing after that. And is that the right source for the business that you have?
Sure, and a lot of times those kind of businesses, if they do survive through, you know, the The SBA, you know, provides the data on the, how many businesses are birthed each year and how many fail, and it's fairly a consistent number, you know, in that whole story of, you know, they're not going to be around after 5 years. So if a company can get that $50,000, $100,000 perhaps from, you know, a combination of those various sources and they survive, then they're working off of their own cash flow and they kind of fall off the radar screen for any statistics of, you know, that food chain that you talked about. So most people, when they're tracking on, you know, angel investor companies that get to a bigger amount, they never really get within the radar screen to be tracked because they've gone an alternative way and they're just surviving or growing through cash flow.
Right, but it isn't just sort of the average companies, because if we look at some of this some spectacular companies and we work backwards and we try to figure out where they get their capital in the first place. So let's take the companies that make the Inc. 500 list, right? I mean, you know, clearly these are high growth private companies. That's the definition of the list. That was the whole point. And you say, go back and you survey them and you ask those guys, where did you get your capital? And you find out that of the companies that made the Inc. 500 list, really, well less than 15% of them, you know, and got money from any kind of informal investor. And, you know, angels are a pretty small, finance a pretty small portion of those companies. So those people are creating high growth companies without necessarily going to angels. Now you say, okay, well, the odds of making the Inc. 500 are a lot higher, okay, because if you get angel money, that's true, but doesn't mean that to be successful, you got to get that kind of money that you for your kind of business, you can make the Inc. 500 with a completely different path than the kind of angel or venture capital path. Those are not that common amongst the companies that make the Inc. 500.
Right, exactly. Now, one of the things that I wanted to dig into a little bit more was regarding sort of this a little bit more about identifying these friends and family, because, you know, we have a lot of listeners that listen from that are entrepreneurs, you know, and they really struggle with the whole idea of going to their friend or their family because they don't think they know anybody that has the kind of money that can help them. And one of the things that you pointed out is that average investment of somebody that's sort of in that category is about $10,000. So, you know, that's one of the things that when we push people back from going to our angel group is that we say, you need to go do a friends and family round and get yourself 10 folks that are going to put $10,000 a piece in to give you your base capital to get your patent or do the stuff so you can be a scalable, you know, bigger company. So I always kind of explain that friends and family is sort of a euphemism. It's not necessarily your friend or your family, but that friend's going to connect you to the person that can do it, that's that business owner or whatever. So based on your experience, how would you really, I mean, in real world, define that friend? Is it really a friend and a family, or is it the one degree of separation of the friend and the family, or both?
Let me say a couple things, and I want to clarify a couple things here. It's not $10,000 isn't the average. It's the median. It's the typical amount, and that's an important distinction, because what it means is that half of the investments out there are more than $10,000 and half are less, but the average investment tends to be actually $77,000, a big number. So it's because there's people out there getting, you know, $1 million and $2 million angel investments. And so that really skews the numbers. But what you get is the kind of patterns that look something like this, that sort of a company that gets angel investment typically, so it gets the average investment of $77,000. Typically, or on average, there's about five investors. So the way that you get to this kind of $350,000 on average through or $400,000 on average for an angel, a company getting an angel investment is multiple people doing this on average. But the typical thing is actually about four or so people doing $10,000. And then that's a different kind of business. So if somebody, you know, is going to typically get $10,000 from four people, that they're not, if you need $1 million, that's probably not going to get you close to that, but you may only need $40,000 or $50,000. Maybe what you need to do is get the kind of money it takes to get a patent on your invention, to get some retail space put together. It's something like that, and then you can use these smaller chunks of money. But in terms of who these people are, it's the book is pointing out that when I say friends and family, they literally are friends and family. They're not one degree of separation. And what tends to happen is that there's a large amount of this activity, like 90% of it, is going to your own friend or your own family member. But about 10% of this is that kind of one degree of separation. Somebody introduces you, you do some networking there. Those percentages, I think, are really informative to anybody who's an entrepreneur, because when people go out and say, I'm going to go raise money and I'm going to go get it from angels, and then they come back and they say, but I don't know any, then you want to ask the question, well, maybe you're better off actually finding the friends and the family that you do know and get money there, and think about smaller amounts of money that you need to do what you're doing in terms of the business, because odds are much greater that you're going to get a small amount of money from somebody who is a friend or family member than you are going to get a large amount of money from a stranger. And if you want to try to get a large amount of money from a stranger, you got to have a very particular kind of business. And if you don't, you probably should have a reality check and say, I'm going to just waste my time. I'm going to wear out the leather on my shoes just trying to go around and find people who are going to be strangers who are going to give me $500,000 for my restaurant concept. It's just very unlikely to happen.
Oh, sure. So is that why you said that the typical angel deal involves is usually more debt than equity, because that friend, since the friends and family are skewing our total number, so because they're maybe loaning that $10,000 to their friend to get their restaurant started or something, so that's sort of skewing that from that the majority of this is done in debt? Because, I mean, all of our investors, as business investors, invest in equity or a convertible security that converts into a larger round later on.
Yeah, so part of this is no. So I'm not talking about the friends and family being included. Actually, if you put the friends and family in to the informal investors, and you're actually getting up to about 65% of all that investment is debt. This is just among the angels. But part of this is this issue of, so who are the people who are going to you and going that way? The people who are going to go through any organized kind of assistance for angels, there's going to be a selection process that are going to make those deals better. And the kinds of angels who are going to want to see a deal that's out there, they're going to that comes through some kind of more formal mechanism, they're going to be looking much more in terms of making an equity investment, because they're skewed towards the guys who are trying to make money doing this as opposed to doing it for other reasons.
Okay, right. So now, interesting, one of the things that always comes up in whenever you get involved in any kind of angel investing sort of stuff, because it is a private equity, a securities transaction, I guess maybe not when it's pure debt, but technically it probably is. And a whole bunch of these folks are not accredited investors. How do you see that playing? Is it just completely off the radar screen from the SEC unregistered offerings? Because these guys it's a personal transaction between two, a couple of folks, and because it would seem to me that it would be technically, if somebody's going to their friends and family and just getting money to get their business going, they're doing it in, they're not doing it in any kind of unregistered formal offering, because these people are unaccredited and they probably don't have an offering document. So.
But I'm not a securities lawyer, and obviously anybody doing this should talk to a securities, an attorney who's got some expertise in securities law. But there's nothing wrong with raising money from unaccredited investors. There's limits on the number of accredited investors.
Right.
of unaccredited investors. But you, if you're talking below 30 investors here, you're talking, you know, four or five people, right? There, there's not necessarily going to be a problem that those people are unaccredited investors. Now, if your goal is that there are going to be some professional investors following on later, they're going to say, I don't like that, because they're going to be worried about a bunch of stuff downstream. So these venture capitalists are going to say, I don't like this kind of way that they did this initially with these unaccredited investors. So if you're worried about the venture capitalists in a later round, then you're going to worry about accredited investors. And if you're worried about going public at some point, you're going to worry about that stuff too. But there's, you know, you can certainly have a person who raises money from four people who are unaccredited investors, and that business grows and makes money and provides a return for those investors without running afoul of securities law.
Yeah. Okay. That's so, you know, since we want to create a show here that folks can really have some takeaways on, let me see if I can sort of restate a couple of things that you've said. And so when a company, because a lot of our listeners, a lot of people that, you know, are really seeking to try to understand this angel marketplace, they're ultimately, you know, their intention is to raise $1 million, let's say. So good, a couple of takeaways from your book and what we've been talking about is that, first of all, is to think about that, you know, not to automatically assume that within your Rolodex of friends and families, that those folks are not candidates to give you some of that initial seed capital to get you through that next level, because their motivations are different. So that's sort of the first thing. I mean, for assuming it's a scalable business, that's, you know, we're talking about those particular types of businesses right now. So the first thing is that, you know, yes, you can go and raise money from friends and family that you would not think of as being investors because of this, you know, evidence of their behavior patterns and their motivations for doing investments of that type.
Right. Fair enough.
Okay. And so then, but the caution is that if you do that and you are going to be going out to business angels and then maybe ultimately venture capital firms, that you do need to get them structured in such a way that it doesn't inhibit follow-on investment down the road.
Right. But there's other things that I think are, you know, implications that come out, you know, we haven't really talked about them, that come out book of somebody who's thinking of, you know, raising $1 million for some business, which is, the first one is this issue of exactly how many angels are there out there that you can go after if that's what you need. And one of the things that I think is an important takeaway of the book is that this idea that's out there that people talk about all the time is that there are many times more angels than there are venture capitalists. If you talk about,
right,
if you're talking about a person who's trying to build a scalable business and and $1 million kind of raise of money, there aren't that many more angels than there are venture capitalists. And that's an important thing to know, because it's not, you know, you shouldn't have this idea that, you know, there's going to be 10 of those angels for every one venture capitalist out there, so it's going to be so much easier to find the angels than it is to find the venture capitalists. Second thing is kind of getting into some things like, well, what does this mean when people are looking at a business, right? So how many of those people asking for that kind of money have successful outcomes? And one of the things that, you know, I point out in the book is something that I look through, which is, you know, using the census statistics, what portion of people actually hit these kinds of growth targets that are these what these sophisticated kind of professional type angels say they want, right? I'm going to invest in some business that's going to have $50 million in 5 years, right? $50 million in sales in 5 years. And you kind of see how incredibly rare that is. You know, you're talking about, for most industries, no more than 1% of businesses, and in a lot of industries, you can actually get down to 0% of businesses that actually do that. And then you say, well, what kind of, you know, what percentage of entrepreneurs do I see as a member of an angel group who show me financial projections that say I'm going to hit $50 million of sales in 5 years? And so I got a bunch of entrepreneurs about 85% of those business plans will say, I'm going to hit $50 million of sales in 5 years. And in those very industries, I actually look at the statistics and say, well, what portion of businesses in those industries actually did hit that? And you get like 1%. And then you start to say, that's why as an angel, no angel worth their salt is going to believe anything that you say in your financial projections, because you get all these people saying, I'm going to be great, when one out of 85 of them are going to be able to do that. That's not the financial projection isn't providing a lot of information. And then you have to realize, well, why are they making their decisions? What are they actually looking for? And understanding, you know, in these groups, what kind of dynamics go on that affect how the angel group comes to a decision? What kind of information are people looking for? And then on the other side is, but if there's only a small, only a small number of people who are angels are successful at it. And so then kind of another takeaway for somebody trying to raise money is, but if a lot of these guys who are angels and that you're going to, and the statistics from some of these angel group investors are that 40% of them have never made any money off of any of their angel investments, then you ask yourself the question, well, am I going to get anything more than money from these guys? Because if I'm getting money from an investor who's in that 40% who's never made any money, why do I think there's value added beyond money from that angel, right? And I should know that. I should, I should think about whether I'm going to the band of angels, and these are guys who actually really know what they're doing, or I'm going to some other angel who's never really made any money, and they want to take a big chunk of my company because they say that they're going to add value. Well, what's the value they're going to add?
Okay, so when you say that, in your description of the typical angel really looks like when they're not necessarily somebody that has a lot of entrepreneurial experience or has already sold a company or built this thing, Are you talking about those business angels that are part of these groups, or are you talking about the full pool of investors that are out there?
Well, when I talk about entrepreneurial experience, I'm talking about the full pool of people out there. But when I'm talking about financial returns that people have made off of their investments, now I'm talking about the people who are accredited investors worth an average of, $12 million each who are part of these angel groups. 40% of those guys have not made money off their angel investments. And then the question, you ask is, and actually from those kinds of people in those angel groups, 3/4 of the money's made that's made from angel investing is made by 7% of the people. When you take statistics like that and you say, okay, so I'm going to get money from somebody who's in an angel group, that doesn't mean that they're necessarily going to be very helpful to me. Right, because
So you're flipping it onto the other side. So if the investors aren't actually making the return, therefore they're not bringing additional value that impacts that return to that entrepreneur. So for the entrepreneur to seek that, thinking that they're getting money and expertise to be successful, that may or may not be part of the equation.
Right, and it may not be the angel's fault that they've never made any money, right? I mean, there's lots of bad luck there, but there's no evidence that they're adding value either if they've never made money off of it, right? I mean, you can't say that they definitely don't add value, but you can't say they definitely do add value if, nothing they've ever invested in has made any money.
Right.
And part of this is, the problem is that angel, when you go to somebody and you ask them for money, what happens is, they're going to give you a price for that money, right? And the question that you have as an entrepreneur is that price worth it? And I would say, sure, if I'm getting money from the band of angels and they can charge me a pretty high price because I think they're going to add a lot of value and they have a track record that shows that. But if you go to a lot of people who are these accredited investors who are high net worth and who've made angel investments, if there's no evidence that those guys can add value, if they've got no proven track record of adding value, why do you want to pay them the same price that you pay the band of angels to get their money, right? It seems like you'd be overpaying because you're not necessarily getting more than money.
So when you say overpaying, are you talking about the amount of equity they give up for the money that they receive?
Exactly, right? So, I mean, this is a transaction. So whatever you're doing, when you're the entrepreneur, you're going to the angel, you're paying the currency you have when you're doing these equity transactions is shares of your company, right? I mean, the value, it's the flip side of the valuation. If somebody says, your business is, worth a certain amount of money, and that's a function of how, you know, how much money I'm going to give you and the equity you're going to take. You know, the flip side of that is that the entrepreneur is giving a number of shares, and they might say, you know what, you as an angel wouldn't necessarily be that helpful to me. I want to give you fewer shares to get the same amount of money than I would give an angel with a track record of helping companies make a lot of money.
So you, so that now that's a very interesting twist on the paradigm, because you're not saying that the angel investment is made based off of the value that that company has set on their IP and, you know, all of the other things that go into the valuation of the company, and so that stock's worth a buck or not. You know, you're saying that the companies that go to these larger groups like a band of angels almost sell their stock at a discounted rate because they think there's additional value on the other side of the table from the dollars coming in?
That's right. I mean, we don't have the formal evidence of this from angels. We actually do know this is true in with venture capitalists, that we have a
sure.
lot of evidence that actually academic studies that will actually show that people will pay about 14% more for a first-tier venture capital firm. And, you know, the thing is probably true there with the angels. But, you know, valuation, right? We, you know, the idea that, you know, your patent is worth X and, you know, this other thing about, you know, the entrepreneur's experience is worth Y, and this all adds up to valuation, it strikes me as a kind of effort to put too much science on something that's actually a negotiation. You know, what
yeah.
you've got is a person who says, I need money, and a person who says, I have some money, and then the person who's asking for money says, the thing I'm asking for is, you know, good in this way, and that the person who's giving the money is saying, I'm helpful to you in this way, and you're trying to figure out a price for that combination of things. That's a negotiation. I you know, I don't think that there's necessarily a clear, you know, price of the various components of that we can say. But, you know, from an entrepreneur's point of view, you know, you're going to be in one of two situations with angels. There's going to only be one person there that's ever going to give you any money, if anybody at all, in which case, you know, you can't really negotiate very much because it's, you know, take that person's deal that they offer you, or you don't get money at all because there's not multiple offers. Or there are multiple people who would be willing to provide you with money, and then the question is, well, why did you choose one over another? There's got to be something about how much equity they're going to demand in return for the money combined with how much value they're going to provide you.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting because I was I think he's listening in today, so I won't actually say his name, but I had lunch yesterday with an angel investor that I know that used to be a part of our group, NBA and I, and then and was in a part of a couple of groups, and then switched and just stayed with the other angel group here in Atlanta, Atlanta Technology Angels. And we were having a discussion about sort of, you know, how I've changed the organization and stuff. And one of the things that came up in that discussion was about this idea of an individual angel going and doing that negotiation like you're talking about, and the frustration that he had as an individual trying to negotiate his own terms when, you know, he didn't have a whole lot of financial muscle behind him, because, you know, it's what he was willing to put in versus what the benefit he gets out of being within a structured angel group, you know, like the Atlanta Technology Angels, because now you have four or five or six of these guys that pull their money and have the ability to better negotiate those terms, right? Because the company now wants that $500,000 or whatever, is willing to, you know, maybe give a lower valuation, in effect pay higher for that money because they're giving up more equity than they normally would have, you know, as part of that negotiation. And our group works a little bit different. We've only just done that a couple of times now with doing that, and usually it's because a company has way too high of a valuation and they come up with some alternative term. But almost always one of the criteria we have for companies is that they have to come to us with already established terms, with a private placement memorandum or with an offering memorandum, so that our investors can decide do they like that or not based on all the other elements of the opportunity and compared to the other things that they're looking at. And so it's the company gets to set the price, in effect, when they come into our group, because we found that most of our guys are kind of like what you said. They still are employed. They still run their own businesses. They're investing passively in these companies, you know, doing a couple of year with the idea that, you know, 5, 6, 7 years from now, they get a big windfall out of some portion of those, not all of them. And, you know, they just want, you know, a passive investment, and they don't want to negotiate those terms. So, you know, it's interesting because I can see what you're talking about. When I was really surprised when I went to talking to those different angel groups at the Angel Capital Association, how much they do get into that negotiation that you're talking about, and those entrepreneurs have to struggle with, do I give up more, do I pay more for that money because I got this pool of folks that are going to get me more money than I would have if I had to go to a whole bunch of individuals to get it.
Yeah, I mean, I just I think there are those issues. You know, there's trade-offs too, because groups make funny decisions, and and there's all kinds of issues that relate to how groups make their decisions and the choices that they make. And so that, you know, one of the trade-offs is, well, yeah, there might be a bunch of advantages to going to a group to raise money, and there might be a bunch of advantages to people being in groups as investors for some of the reasons that you talked about and a bunch of others. But one of the things I try to outline in the book is that there's another side to that too, which is, you know, a lot of the times you get decision-making in these angel groups that looks something like the following, which is kind of horse trading. You know, you support my deal and I'll support yours. Well, that kind of behavior is not giving you necessarily, you know, backing the best companies or, you know, people with strong personalities sway discussions. People with weaker personalities don't sway those discussions, and you end up with focused on the kinds of deals that one set of people like. You know, we know all this stuff is just sort of standard things about how people make decisions in groups. It's just that just because it's a group doesn't necessarily make it better than the individual. You really have to balance the pros and the cons.
So now we originally had this interview set up, I think, through your publishers for 45 minutes. We've gone almost an hour now, and I appreciate you staying on longer, and I don't know if you have to run. But we do have somebody that's called in that wants to ask a question to you. So can I open up the phone line to take this question? He's an entrepreneur. He's been successful in raising lots of different types of capital over the years, and so I'm interested to hear what his question is. Brian, you're on the air.
Yes, hello, Karen. How are you today?
Good. Introduce yourself and your business briefly Scott knows a little bit about what it is that you're doing and to set up your question.
Okay. Hello, Scott. My name is Brian Javelin. I'm a president and CEO of MyOnlineToolbox.com. It's a collaboration platform for the home repair remodeling industry, and I've done well in raising money predominantly through what I like to call sophisticated angels. And I guess the first thing is a statement. I've been listening to you, and you're doing a great job in explaining the topic to listeners, but I think you can cut to the chase when you say angels in three words, three sections. You got accredited angels, which are predominantly people with money who will give you some money. You got sophisticated angels, which could, you know, give you a tremendous amount of wealth of experience to support the financial investment they'll give you. And then you have angel groups that pretty much are right now working as complicated as working with a VC. I really treat them as they all have the word angel within their title, but they really operate differently. And if I went to make a choice, I would put the most value towards the sophisticated angel because he is motivationally looking to let you achieve your exit strategy. The accredited angel might have money, and he might even be a little bit of a nuisance in your business, but he does have the money. The angel group is definitely going to be a fight to close the deal, but all three of them are classified as angels. Putting that aside, what my statement is, or I guess my question is, which I agree to you when you said the bottom line is all of this becomes a negotiation when somebody invests in you, but wouldn't you state that right now, due to the economic circumstance and uncertainty we're facing, that right now any money should be viewed as valuable and get into that negotiation sooner than later, because unless you're cash flow positive and able to survive the storm that's facing us now, whether we want to classify it as that or not, the bottom line is it's going to be dragging on through 2009 and possibly through 2011, and unless you're cash flow positive, take the money, negotiate a deal, and make sure your business survives the impending storm that's in front of us. Would you not agree?
Right, absolutely. And you know, I guess I should make two points here. One is absolutely in this current climate, the odds that a person's getting multiple financing offers are really low. That doesn't mean that there aren't people out there that have a choice between more than one financing source. So, you know, you have people still today where there's two venture capitalists interested in funding their business. There's two angel groups that are interested in funding their business. And, you know, for most people, if you can get anything, that's great. But if you have the choice, then you really actually need to think about, well, you know, is one actually going to provide me more value than the other, not just, you know, how much equity are they going to take to do that? The other point that I would make is that I agree with you actually on the idea that there's a big difference between an angel who is sophisticated and an angel who's unsophisticated. The only clarification that I'd make on this is just because there's an angel group doesn't mean the angel group is composed of sophisticated angels. And in fact, a lot of groups these days are being structured as funds or as kind of networks where people are kind of compelled to invest money, and those kinds of structures can lead to more passive investing, and you can get unsophisticated angels being mixed in with sophisticated angels. So angel group is, you know, not the same term as, you know, 100% sophisticated angels.
I concur. I think you did a very good explanation.
Okay, great. Well, what kind of Scott, as we begin to wrap up here, what's your takeaway for an angel that's listening right now, and then what's your takeaway for an entrepreneur that's listening right now?
So the big takeaway for an angel is you have to decide whether you're in this to make money as an angel or you're in it to just help people out. And if you're in it to just help people out, you know, sort of God bless you, and we don't really have to worry about much more. If you're in it to make money, then you got to pay attention. You got to realize that there's things that a small number of people do, and they do them differently than the vast majority of people who aren't making a lot of money. That sophisticated angels, in the terms of the last caller, are not the same as the unsophisticated ones. And if you want to make money at this, you want to figure out how to be of the sophisticated variety. For the entrepreneur, it's just because it's the term angel doesn't mean that it's some sort of golden solution to everything, and that we tend to say things like, you know, angels are smart money and friends and family are dumb money. On average, that's actually not true. You want to figure out who's the right source of capital for you, how much value do they add. If they're adding value, does it justify the cost? And not just say, oh, I need to have an angel so I can get a venture capitalist, and that kind of mental model just doesn't work most of the time.
So that was for your takeaways for both investors and entrepreneurs.
That's right.
Okay. So, and it was, I thought it was really interesting too, a comment that you had made earlier about the amount of return on investment that angels typically get. You know, we've, in my research that I had done, kind of leaning into where I am now, it seemed like a lot of times it was because of making an emotional decision, not necessarily, you know, doing their due diligence or not having the opportunity to ensure that enough money got into the company to help them succeed. They might be one person that put $25,000 in but didn't know if there was any more coming in, and the company really needed $200,000 to actually get to that next milestone. And so I put together a series of books, How to Be an Angel Investor, that really addressed that. And it's interesting because the folks of our members that have used those books, we try to take what they know about stock markets and about real estate market, and they approach it with the expectation that, you know, one, similar to the VCs, that 1 in 10, you know, is going to really make it, and hopefully it's enough to make up for the 3 that completely failed, that you lost all your money, you know, and the 3 that kind of broke even, you maybe just matched your money, and the 2 that sort of did okay or whatever, right? And that you gotta do enough of them over time in order to make up for the, you know. So overall, it, you know, it probably comes in that your 7% actually make their money, but you know, because that's just the nature of businesses going out of business and people not having all the right information when they make those decisions, or the company not getting all the capital they really need to be successful, you know, all of those factor into a company failing. And so, you know, it's interesting that you found that as well in, you know, sort of the downside of investors. There's this emotional, oh, I'm going to create some, get so much money from being an investor. But in reality, if they don't really approach it with a level of sophistication, their likelihood of losing their funds is pretty strong.
Right. And I mean, to me, there's one very simple thing that even a lot of people who purport to be sophisticated angels don't adhere to. And I personally find myself, it's always a battle to adhere to this, which is if you believe, right, that 1 in 10 of your investments is going to make you money, right, and you want to have a particular rate of return, you know, say you want to have a 20% rate of return, you need to always keep in your mind, right, that you got to have one investment that coupled with 9 others at 0 will give you that 20%, and
that's a
high number, right?
Yeah.
And you always say, well, at the margin, well, this one isn't going to give me the return that I hope for, but I really like it. And you keep doing that all the time. And now your pool that you got the 1 in 10 on, the expectations are not as high as they should be. You hit your 1 in 10, and your returns are lower than you'd wanted, because each time you backed away because you said, well, I can sort of make this. It's not really going to give me my 5X, or it's not going to really give me my 10X, but, well, it's, you know, 3X for this one, that's okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's that discipline in the process, you know, because it ultimately, you know, when we separate subjective and objective investors and how we work in our world, in our vernacular that we use, when we talk about those objective investors, they start out, you know, making a business decision. They look at, you know, they know they're going to make an investment this quarter, so they're looking at 3 or 4 deals. The only way for them to narrow it down to decide which one they're going to invest in is to look for reasons not to invest. You know, and that's contrary to how entrepreneurs think and most people think, but they look for, you know, as a management team or the terms or, you know, whatever it might be as reasons why they may not invest compared to the other ones that they look at. And then when they finally get down to the 2, well, they make that decision based off of their emotional. They decide the 1 or the 2, and hopefully it's not because they dislike it, even though the returns, like you say, are not as high. You know, that they do still keep that business hat on when they make that emotional decision on which one they're actually going to write the check for. You know, but a lot of times it's because, you know, they just, you know, if this one wins, you know, if this one, you know, it's a medical product, you know, oh, it'll be, it'll change the world if this one actually works, you know. And
right.
So, okay, well, anything else as we close out that you would like to share with our listening audience? I thank you so much for taking the time to come and talk to us about your book and all that you've learned. It's been incredibly insightful and educational and entertaining for me, and hopefully our audience thought it was as well. Anything that you'd like to add as you close out?
No, I think we pretty much covered it. I think that, you know, I guess the last message is just that, you know, this isn't easy, and it isn't something you can do well, you know, just by not putting much effort into it. Either side, if you're the entrepreneur looking for funding or you're the investor trying to make those investments.
Okay, great. And again, we're with Dr. Scott Shane. The book is Fool's Gold, The Truth Behind Angel Investing in America. It's available through Amazon. It's, if you're on the blogtalkradio.com, Karen-Rand's site, you can click on the link there to go directly to Amazon and purchase that book now. But is it also available in Barnes & Noble and some of your regular retail stores?
It is, but anybody who's actually thinking of either being an entrepreneur or investor should know that it's discounted on Amazon, so you should save the money and go there.
Yeah, there you go. Okay. So thank you again, Scott, for joining in with us and sharing your insights, and I'm looking forward to maintaining a relationship with you and sharing thoughts all along the way as we continue to sort of tackle this angel investor/entrepreneur marketplace.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, this concludes the show for Spec Talk Radio, Southeast Private Equity Community Radio show that brings the entrepreneurs and the investors together. Please tune in again next week and stay tuned for what that show will cover. We're working on putting together a show on tax credits for carbon tax credits. That may not happen next week, it may be the week after that. Otherwise, we'll have interesting folks to interview and talk about angel investing or entrepreneur strategies. If you want more information about what LaunchFN does or more information about attracting angel investors, then please go to launchfn.com, LaunchFN, or launchfundingnetwork.com. Also, you can go to our blog, entrepreneurblogspace.com, and get lots of information there. And we are doing a webinar this coming Tuesday on the 16th at 4 o'clock Eastern Standard Time on how to pitch angel investors. And in that webinar, I'll be incorporating some of this information into how do you attract that friends and family round, as well as when you get in front of the business groups. And so how do you talk to those different types of investors so that you can secure their money to grow your business? And what are those investors looking for? And to sign up for that free webinar, you can do it within the launchfn.com website on the main page there, or you can go to findinvestorcapital.com. That's findinvestorcapital.com. Sign up there. It'll send you a web link for the webinar through GoToMeeting, and that'll be 4 o'clock Eastern Standard Time on the 16th. Thank you very much for tuning in to Spec Talk Radio. This is Karen Rands, and onward and upward. Let's go create, be architects of our future, be economic architects as we build our businesses and secure economic freedom through investing in early stage companies, even if it's the 1 in 10 with a big return, as Scott said, or just building those businesses successful ourselves. Thank you very much for listening. Bye-bye. We'll be right back.